This is Mac Format This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features from the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up, the real value of Mobile Me.
It really is a huge bundle of stuff and a huge increase in the convenience of your daily life for £5 a month.
Is it a good investment for you? Adam Banks investigates the pros and cons of Apple's push technology. Also ahead, locking down Wi-Fi.
It really doesn't take much to secure your wireless network. And it's easy to do, it's convenient to use, and it makes your home network much, much more secure.
Chris Finn shows you network security measures that are simple, convenient, and smart. All that and Q&A coming up on Mac Format This Week. And don't forget, Mac Format is the UK's number one Mac magazine. Each month we bring you the best Mac hints and tips. UK customers can subscribe to Mac Format by going to myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/MFC/2003 or by clicking now on the enhanced podcast link. With the resources of Mac Format magazine, this is Mac Format This Week. Hello everyone, I'm Brad Gibson. In 2008, Apple revamped its suite of online services known as .Mac. Now called Mobile Me, the service lets you sync your email, contacts, and calendars between devices, host websites, provides online storage and transferring of files, and also lets you create online photo galleries, all for the asking price of £59. Apple doesn't publicly say how popular its Mobile Me service is, but it has garnered some widespread support with the advent of push technology that allows Mac users and iPhone users to more seamlessly share content. But like any service, its value is in the eye of the beholder. While Mobile Me offers a number of useful features that might be great if you're on the road quite often, does it really offer captivating features for the iMac user at home? Mac Format contributor Adam Banks wondered the same thing and went looking for some answers. He wrote about the pros and cons of Mobile Me in his September issue feature entitled, What Makes Mobile Me Worth Paying £59 a Year For? He joins us now from Newcastle. Adam, thanks again for joining us.
Hi, Brad. It's a pleasure.
Mobile Me has changed a lot over the years when it was simply .Mac. Probably its biggest addition is the push technology. And for those not familiar with push, please explain briefly how it works.
Yeah, I think you and I are probably at the same Apple Expo in San Francisco where they first announced .Mac. And it wasn't all that clear at first how useful it was going to be. But now, with Mobile Me, definitely one of the great things about it is push. And essentially, it means you just always have the same stuff on all your devices instantly, all the time. It's not like syncing your iPod, where you plug it into your Mac and there's this explicit process where stuff gets copied across. You may think you always get email instantly, but of course it really depends how often your mail program is set to check the server or how often you sit there clicking receive. Again, there's no explicit process of checking your email. It's just there. Within a second, literally, of someone pressing send, your iPhone goes bing, and there's your mail. And it's not just mail either. If you had a contact in your Mac's address book, it's already on your iPhone as well. It can even be a bit too quick. If you start typing a to-do item into the mail app in Mac OS X, you'll see a little sync message pops up at the bottom left of the window if you've got Mobile Me. And the to-do item appears simultaneously on your iPhone, even before you've started typing what it is you have to remember to do.
So if you're out on your iPhone or your laptop Mac, having this ability that you just described is incredibly convenient, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's worth pointing out, push is mainly something that works on your iPhone. It's something that works from your Mac to your iPhone. For example, the mail app on your Mac still has to check the server at preset intervals. It doesn't really affect the way you get mail on a Mac. But sync works both ways. So when you change something on your iPhone, it does go back to your Mac as well. Or it works always between however many devices you have. So you might have an iMac, a MacBook, an iPhone, even PCs. If you're unfortunate enough to have to use a Windows PC, then you get a little app that downloads along with iTunes, and it makes Mobile Me work with Windows as well. It's almost as seamless. Obviously, you don't have the Apple Mail app, but it can talk to Microsoft Outlook and so on. And both your email and your contacts are always the same between all your machines.
Right, and push technology is really great. I mean, we've talked a lot of great things, positives here in the last few minutes, but there are a few drawbacks to push technology and Mobile Me when you add work email into the mix, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, the issue here, I suppose, is the same issue that you always run into with work IT systems, which is you may not want to do things the same way that they want to do things. I mean, a lot of people assume that push and syncing only work with MobileMe, and that's not quite true. You can actually sync an iPhone, for example, to a Microsoft Exchange server, which a lot of businesses use.
Right.
So you can get your work email right on your iPhone, and you can even sync all your calendar events and appointments. So I've got to confess, that's not something I've tried myself, but it's all set up, it works, and you can use your iPhone with a business IT system. But of course, then you're not really using MobileMe. You're not getting all the benefits of that. And you can't sync to Exchange and MobileMe at the same time. You have to choose one or the other. It can also work with other email systems and online services like the Google services, which some businesses are starting to use now. Again, there's limitations. At the moment, you can't get your Google Mail pushed to your iPhone, but you can get your Google Mail on your iPhone. You can access it either via browser or you can get it in the Mail app on the iPhone via IMAP, which means every time you check your mail, you go into the Gmail server and you're seeing exactly the same mail you would see if you logged in from another web browser. Again, it's not actually using MobileMe, so you're not getting the full benefits. It'd be nice if all of those things, Google, Exchange, and various other systems could just work with each other, but that's not really something Apple can deliver. That's something the industry has to sort out.
Right, exactly. And next is general purpose online storage, which is a really big part of MobileMe. You've got 20 gigabytes of storage through MobileMe for emails, photo galleries, websites, your iDisk. Now, there are a lot of other services that offer free storage, but the simplicity and the ease of uploading and building and accessing your content remotely does seem to give MobileMe some added benefit. I mean, don't you think?
Yeah, this was the thing that came up again and again when we were doing this feature for Mac Format. It's the ease of use. I can't stress enough how easy it is. You don't really even have to set it up. You know, you just click that button that says, I want to sign up for MobileMe, and it's done. And even things that would normally be really hard become easy. For example, if you want to create a quick website or a blog, there's lots of software that lets you do that relatively easily, but there's always a big faff with connecting to the server and working out what you have to do on the server and making the server work with the software that you're working with and FTPing stuff up. There's just absolutely none of that with MobileMe. If you use iWeb to create a website, you literally click one button and there it is online and everything works. And then there's things like MobileMe galleries, which you can create directly from within the iPhoto. You just select the photos you want, they're online straight away, and they look really great. So it is an ease of use factor and a convenience factor and an Apple-ness factor, you know, that things don't just work, they work really well. And your iDisk, yeah, I mean, there's other online services like Dropbox, for example, that'll give you some free space online. But, I mean, the basic Dropbox account offers you something like, I think it's 2 gigabytes, which is a long way off Apple's 20 gigabytes. And the next step up, if you need more storage, costs $10 a month, which is about £6. So that's more than the price of MobileMe, just for the online storage facility, which you're getting almost thrown in with MobileMe. So that's the kind of thing that I mean when I talk about MobileMe actually being pretty good value for £59 all in.
And briefly, with the advent of the iPhone, Apple has added in some nice features that allow you to control your iPhone in the event of it being lost or stolen. And we've talked about these with Chris Finn just a few weeks back here on the show. Those are Remote Wipe and Find My iPhone. Go over those just really quickly as part of your overall look at its value of MobileMe.
Yeah. These are new things that have been made possible by the iPhone 3.0 update, which, of course, iPhone 3G users can get, as well as if you get the new 3GS. Remote Wipe, I'm not so sure how useful that is. I mean, I suppose, it, you know, if you're Vanessa Hudgens and you've lost your iPhone, it's really quite useful to be able to press a button and delete everything on it before anybody else finds it. But
right.
For the rest of us, you have to be really sure before you press that button, because that's the end of any chance of getting it back. You know, your phone's finished. There's no way of connecting it back to you. What's much more useful, definitely, is Find My iPhone, because you just go to the MobileMe website, you log in, and almost straight away you get a map up and the crosshair comes up and it shows you where your phone is. And if you wait a few more seconds, it does that triangulation thing and it gets more accurate. So it can definitely tell you which pub you left your phone in. Maybe not the exact bar stool, but you can find that phone. One thing we absolutely must mention about Find My iPhone is that if you do lose your iPhone and you go to me.com and you log in and click Find My iPhone, the only thing you're going to get is a message saying, hey, why not turn this feature on your iPhone, which is really annoying. So anybody that does have an iPhone and MobileMe, go to settings in your iPhone now and turn that feature on, and then it's going to be there when you need it.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about the added benefits of MobileMe to enhance iPhone and iPod Touch users, but it's still very useful for non-iPhone users too. Tell us about that and what they need to really be thinking about when they consider MobileMe.
so many of the things that people talk about with MobileMe are specific to the iPhone, like Push. But in fact, people often have more than one Mac. They may have to use a work Mac and a home Mac, or they may have a desktop Mac Pro and a MacBook. They may have to use PCs as well. And syncing things between all these different machines can be a real nightmare. There's no immediately easy way to do it. So you get into that situation where you only use email on one machine because otherwise it gets too complicated and you get some messages on one machine and some on the other and it all gets mixed up. Or you end up using some horrible webmail service that looks terrible and just doesn't feel Apple-ish to use just because you can get to the same system easily from more than one machine. And with MobileMe, that's not the case. You never have to worry about it. Both your email and all your contacts and your calendars, everything really that you need to keep your life going is automatically exactly the same on every machine you use. You use all the time. And the benefit of that is almost indescribable until you've tried it. You don't realise how much time you spend messing about trying to keep things the same on more than one machine.
Right.
Until you don't have to do it anymore.
And finally, it's worth bearing in mind that MobileMe comes with free 24-hour live chat support. And I didn't know that, and I've been using it for over 2 years now.
Well, there you go. And that's a really great extra feature. And I've used it. And, you know, tech support call centers don't have the most fantastic reputation. And yeah, the guys have names that you can't pronounce. But they know their stuff, and they respond very fast, and you can get an answer straight away. It's excellent.
So let's get to the meat of this issue, and that is the real value of MobileMe. I mean, as I look at it, and I'm a Mac and an iPhone user, I can see real value. But for others, it might not be worth the price. I mean, how do you see this?
Yeah, there's a tendency when it comes to the internet to think everything should be free, but it's not. You can certainly live without MobileMe, but I do think 59 quid is pretty reasonable. Even if you only use some of the features, like the iDisk and MobileMe galleries, and, you know, if you do use iWeb, it's so great. And just having a decent email service that you can access from a proper email app and from a web browser, and it actually looks and works the same in both, with the same mail folders and so on. Maybe you shouldn't have to pay extra for that, but the reality is you do, and I think it's worth it. But I agree with you that the real clincher is if you have an iPhone, then I think you'd be crazy not to use MobileMe, because it totally works, and it's like adding a fiver a month to your tariff and getting into a whole new league of convenience.
If I was just working at home, I didn't have an iPhone, I didn't have a laptop, I didn't need to access remotely an iDisk or photos or whatever, obviously, as you continue to think about what you would not use that MobileMe has, it value somewhat goes down for those who are just a one-man band, say, at home all the time.
Yeah, there are definitely people that wouldn't get anything out of MobileMe. It is a connection, communication system. If you don't need to connect to other users, if you don't need to share with other users, if you don't need to make things the same between different machines, then okay, you don't need MobileMe. But the point I would make is, how many of us does that really apply to? I think a smaller number every day.
I got to tell you, I don't think I could live without MobileMe now on my phone when I'm out and about so much. I mean, just having that simplicity of bringing up my address book that I have at home, bringing up the videos, bringing up the email, and more importantly, when I send an email from my iPhone, it ends up in my sent box in Apple Mail on my laptop at home. I mean, that simplicity of being able to have everything, whether I send it or whether I receive it, whether I trash it, it's just fantastic. And that, to me, is what MobileMe is really all about.
Absolutely. It's the way that all these services should have worked ever since they were first invented, but they never have, and now they just do.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, I think the value of it for £59, yeah, I'd like a little bit more storage maybe, but other than that, I can't think of anything else it doesn't do that I would like.
Yeah, I mean, when they first made the switch from .Mac to MobileMe, they messed it up, no doubt about it. But now that it all works, it really is a huge bundle of stuff and a huge increase in the convenience of your daily life for £5 a month.
Yeah, the Push technology at first, as you and I both know, was a little suspect. I mean, it didn't work really well.
It didn't push. That was the basic problem. Yeah.
Exactly. It didn't push, and now it really does, and it works perfectly pretty much all the time that I've been using it. So I guess basically the final verdict that we have on MobileMe is, if you have an iPhone, it's essential. If not, you need to look at your overall needs and see whether that £59 a month is really worth it.
Yeah, and I think if you decide not to get it this year, you're going to be getting it next year.
And why do you say that?
Because I think everybody's doing more and more that's connected with other users. It's just becoming more the norm to be constantly messaging other users and communicating with each other, with other users, and sharing files with other users. And particularly as people work less and less sitting around the same office and more over the internet and collaborating, there are so many solutions for this kind of thing. And MobileMe is one that you can get right now and just works. and is, I think, really good value.
Yeah, it really is. Adam, thanks for joining us, putting a value on the value of MobileMe.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Adam Banks is a contributor to MacFormat magazine. His four-page feature entitled What Makes MobileMe Worth Paying £59 a Year For appears in the September issue of MacFormat, which is on sale now. If you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch, you're bound to have noticed the ever-growing number of wireless networks that are on every street corner. But just as surprising is the number of unsecured Wi-Fi networks. The reasons for locking down your Wi-Fi network are many, from securing your data from others to protecting your monthly data transfer rate if you have a broadband package that's capped. The fact is, securing your wireless network is a good idea, and it's fairly simple on a Mac. Deputy Editor Chris Finn joins us from the newsroom now with a checklist that appears as a how-to in the September issue that you can use to lock down your Wi-Fi network for good. And Chris, what's great about this advice and these techniques is that they can be used with pretty much any wireless router, right?
Yeah, that's right. The good thing is that the lessons that we'll talk about here, the techniques that we'll talk about, can be applied to, as you say, pretty much any router that you have. We'll be talking largely about the Apple base station and also the Netgear router that I use in the walkthrough. But you're right, pretty much any router, it's the same sort of techniques you'll be applying. The names might be slightly different, but the techniques are the same.
Yeah. Now, before we start, let's address passwords. People need to remember that a password is basically just like the physical keys to your home, and you've got to use some common sense here, right?
Sure. I mean, the world wouldn't be a very secure place if there was one key and it opened every lock that was out there. And yet that's what some people do, is that they'll use a single password for each for every site or every computer and service and piece of hardware they have, all that sort of stuff. And the problem with that is it is very insecure, and that if one of your passwords becomes compromised, then those details can be used to log into pretty much any site. So, but then again, you know, I understand that using different passwords for everything is difficult, and it's complex, and it can be a huge burden on you. So one thing I suggest in this tutorial is coming up with a sort of mnemonic, an easy way to generate a unique password for each site that you go to, but that's based on something that you can remember, so that even if you don't remember the password, you can sort of work it out. And the example I give is, let's say you use a sort of root password of an at symbol and then PPL and then the number 3, which looks like the word Apple. It's just written out in a slightly different way. And you can then append different sites to that. So let's say your Amazon password now might then be APPLE Amazon. And for your Mac, it might be APPLE Mac. Something like that. It's just an easy way to create a system of passwords that are easy to understand and remember, but very secure at the same time.
Yeah, that is a good idea. Okay, now on to the four steps. First is protecting the router itself. And what do you need to know here?
So by default, most routers will come in a particular configuration with particular passwords used to access its administration pages. The airport base station from Apple is slightly different here, but most other routers from most manufacturers, including the ones you would get bundled with your ISP, you configure them by logging into a particular IP address that is the configuration page inside that router.
Right.
And the password to access that particular config page is usually something very basic. It's like admin and then admin, or admin and then password. So if you don't change those to begin with, then later on, it doesn't matter how secure you've been with your password, how secure you've been with filtering or anything like that, if your router itself is open to abuse, then folks could log into your router and change those settings and make it less secure in other places. So make sure you've locked down the login details for the router itself.
And if you don't change these, I mean, it's really easy for anyone who maliciously wants to have an intent to get in to log into your router, change your security settings, potentially locking you out from getting back in.
Yeah, absolutely. And the good thing is with Apple, it actually prompts you as part of the setup assistant with a Airport Extreme base station or a Airport Express or a time capsule, it prompts you to create a new admin password for your machine and offers to add it to your keychain automatically. So that's nice and easy for you. But you're absolutely right. If you don't lock this down, then you're potentially leaving your router open to other people coming in. And as you say, they could even lock you out of your own router.
Next is the Service Set Identifier, or SSID, for the router. And this is basically that name people see of the router when it shows up on their list of Wi-Fi networks. Now, you say it's important to change the name. Why?
This is, a sort of social networking thing rather than a technology thing, but I also think it's worth changing the name of your router, the SSID of your router, because if you have a router that's just called its default name, like Netgear or Bbox or Sky, then to me, as somebody who's quite tech-savvy, if I see that name appearing in my list of Wi-Fi networks, I'm going to assume that the people who've configured that haven't configured it particularly well, the fact that they haven't seen fit to even change the SSID. So if I'm looking through a list of Wi-Fi networks, and if you're maliciously trying to find one that's, you know, going to have the easiest job to get into, then one with an SSID that's a very sort of default thing is going to sort of present itself as a more obvious target to you than something else. You can go one step further, though, and that's you can actually hide the SSID completely, so that when somebody clicks on their on a Mac on the airport menu in the menu bar, or goes into the system tray in Windows and looks for searches for existing networks, you can stop the name from appearing. Now, it doesn't make it any less difficult to connect to. In fact, if you click on your airport menu, you'll actually see a command in there that says "Join Other Network," and that's where you'd manually enter the SSID of the network you're trying to connect to. It doesn't make it any more difficult for you to connect to as somebody's trying to connect to that network, but it makes it that bit more secure because it's not being broadcast. It's not a particularly ultra-secure way of doing it, because it can be sniffed, it can be discovered by somebody with particularly malicious intent, but it's sort of that thing of making it as difficult as possible.
Third on your list is filtering for MAC addresses, which basically means allowing only certain MACs with a certain identifying number to be allowed access. And I have to tell you, this is a great idea, because to me, this is like putting your network in a bank vault with 50 padlocks on it.
Yeah, it's not a bad analogy. I mean, the thing is, the way that the MAC address filtering works, and it's important that we talk here about the fact that in this context, MAC is not short for Macintosh. MAC is capital M, capital A, capital C, which starts for Media Access Control. And every network port in the world has a unique MAC address. So your airport card and your Ethernet port on your Mac will have different and unique MAC addresses. Same with your iPhone, and every single thing that connects to a network has this unique MAC address. Mm-hmm. It's a group of 6 octets. The great thing about that is that's, as I say, unique. So what you can do is you can say to your router, okay, don't let anybody connect to this network except these particular MAC addresses that I'm going to whitelist. It's sort of turning it on its head. It's not how most people think about security, but in this case, we're saying, okay, nobody can connect, nobody at all, apart from these ones that I particularly want to allow. And you can find out your MAC address for your airport card or your Ethernet port very easily in system preferences. Apple calls them something, as you'd expect, Apple calls them something slightly different. With Apple, it's the airport ID and the Ethernet ID. But you can find those addresses out, and there's usually a command somewhere in your router setup to actually say, apply MAC address filtering and allow these particular machines to connect.
Chris, clarify this for us in terms of this identifying number. Is it an exact identifying number, or is it a range of numbers?
No. Each machine will have a very specific, single, unique number. And as I say, it will be different for your airport card, your Wi-Fi card, as it will be for your Ethernet, for your wired connection. Bluetooth will have a MAC address as well. So all these network ports are different physical, unique MAC addresses. It's important to remember as well that these are very distinct from IP addresses. With an IP address, that's the number that your Mac or your PC or any other network-connected device is given by your router, usually with DHCP, as a temporary placeholder so that it knows where it is in the network, so that it knows where to direct traffic that's passing through it.
Right.
But that's a temporary thing that's assigned by your router, very different from these static fixed MAC addresses that these network ports have.
We talked about passwords earlier, and while they're great, password encryption is just another level of protection that you really need.
Most folks, I guess, when they're talking about securing the wireless network, think about the idea of a password to access that network. And while that's certainly very good, when you're applying a password to a wireless network, you're actually doing more than just saying, let me onto this network because I know the password. That password's actually a key, an encryption and decryption key that actually allows the router to, as soon as data leaves your Mac or your PC, as it's streaming through the air to the router itself, all that data is encrypted, which means that it's complete gibberish. It's absolute gobbledygook to anybody who could sort of get connected to it and could could sniff it, could look at the packets as they're travelling. It's absolute nonsense. And what that key does, that password, is it allows your Mac, as it's sending information, to encrypt it. So it's encrypted with that key, and then when it gets to its destination, it's decrypted with the same key. So as it's being transferred, it's gibberish, but at each end, it's perfectly intelligible. And that's what that password actually does. As we've said a dozen times before, more probably on the podcast and in Mac format, try not to use WEP encryption, WEP encryption. It's technically a security measure, but it's been cracked so comprehensively that it's really not worth doing. You should be applying WPA encryption to your wireless network at home. There's a couple of different flavours of that. There's WPA2, which is the current sort of strongest consumer level of protection, which is what you should be applying. And you'll see that as you set up. In fact, you know, Apple in the Airport Express base stations and the others pushes you towards that. That's its default setting anyway. You might find that other routers suggest you go for a much simpler encryption level. You may have older devices in your network that struggle with these higher encryption levels, but what to do is to try applying the most secure WPA2 first, and if some of your older kit can't connect to that, try only applying WPA, and if they can't connect to that, then I guess your only option is to go for WEP, WEP encryption. But you know, try the most secure, and then if as they fail to connect, you can reduce and reduce and reduce your level of security you have on that network.
Right, right. So there you have it. Four great ways to secure your Wi-Fi network. Chris, thanks for some really valuable advice on securing Wi-Fi networks.
A pleasure, Brad, as always.
Chris Finn is deputy editor of MacFormat magazine. His two-page how-to on securing your wireless network appears on page 62 in the September issue, which is on sale now. And don't forget, MacFormat is the UK's number one Mac magazine. Each month we bring you great hints and tips. U.S. customers can subscribe to MacFormat now by going to imsnews.com/MacFormat or by clicking on the Enhanced Podcast link now and entering the promo code 2003. Questions and answers on every episode of MacFormat this week, and Trevor Middleton joins us again to answer your questions. Hello, Mr. Middleton.
Hello, Mr. Gibson. How are you?
I am very good. Hope you are doing well this summer. Let's get right into it. If you have questions for Trevor, either about your Mac, iPod, or iPhone, you can send them to him at machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And don't forget, as we tell you every show, tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. Question one comes to us from Bruce Gilbert in Perth, Western Australia. He wrote us, I have a MacBook Pro running macOS 10.5.8. My problem is my email program won't remember my keychain password, even though I have ticked remember my password in the dialog box. I tried verifying and repairing the keychain in the keychain access utility, but it really made no difference. Can you help me fix this? Trevor?
Okay, well, Bruce, if this problem's only a sporadic one, it could be that your ISP is experiencing authentication or even timeout issues. If the problem occurs every time you launch your email application, it could be a problem with the keychain itself. So, first of all, go back into keychain access, which, for those of you who don't know where it is in the utilities folder within the applications. Double-click the names of each of the keychains used by your mail program and make sure that the access control tab shows that the keychain is authorized to access the email program all the time, which it almost certainly is. Next, check the settings for the keychain. You'll find those by going to the Change Settings for Keychain login in the Edit menu of the Keychain Access application. Make sure that your keychain isn't set to lock after a specified period of time. Very often, that's the cause of this problem. Finally, another possibility is that you've recently changed your account password by using the Install DVD rather than by going to System Preferences. In this case, go back into the Edit menu of Keychain Access and choose Change Password for Keychain Login. If you can't remember your old password, just go to the File menu and choose to delete the old login keychain. The next time you log in, your new password will become the main keychain password, and that should resolve the issue for you, Bruce.
All right, question two is from Jonathan Brook in Worcester. He wrote us, when I load up my Windows Boot Camp partition, it doesn't always load the hardware drivers. For example, I can't use the volume keys on my MacBook's keyboard. Windows also reports a DNS error whenever this occurs. What should I do? Trevor?
Well, Jonathan, I've recently had the dubious pleasure of installing 30 copies of Windows on 30 MacBooks in a school. Yeah, exactly.
That must have been so much fun.
Absolutely as much fun as it sounds, Brad.
Like poking yourself in the eye. Go ahead.
Slightly less pleasant than that. Now, I must admit, I've seen a lot of these issues with Boot Camp on both those Macs and on other Macs as well. So this, as I say, is based on bitter experience. So, first of all, check your copy of Windows, Jonathan. Make sure it meets Apple's system requirements for Windows precisely. Otherwise, it may not work. I'm saying no more than that, but do check that copy of Windows. And I stress the word copy. Secondly, you may have the wrong Boot Camp drivers. I've seen lots of people try to be clever, and when they buy a new MacBook, they swap out the hard disk from one MacBook to another, which means they have the wrong Boot Camp drivers for the hardware on the new Mac. So, did you use someone else's installation DVD to install the Boot Camp drivers? Check that out. That would also cause the DNS service error message in Windows. That denotes to me that the network driver isn't loading properly, the Ethernet driver or whichever network driver you're using. As to the keyboard issue, there was an issue linked to the Windows process associated with the Apple Media Eject button. So check that that process isn't running by going to Force Quit, which you can do using Task Manager, Control-Alt-Delete. I must admit, Jonathan, given the problems you're having, I'd be tempted to wipe that Boot Camp petition and start again, possibly with a different copy of Windows, a new copy of Windows this time. So don't forget, for Windows XP, you'll need Service Pack 2 or Service Pack 3. And Boot Camp 2.1 must be installed if you want to upgrade Windows XP to Service Pack 3 or Windows Vista to Service Pack 1. Check those system requirements. I suspect they may be at the heart of this problem. Brad.
And our final question comes to us from Ollie Harrison in Preston, Lancashire. He writes, I have a 17-inch MacBook Pro that has invented its own sleep pattern. Sometimes it goes to sleep when it should. Other times it has gone to sleep unexpectedly while I tried to record TV shows with my Equinox tube stick. Trevor, how can I fix this?
Well, Ollie, when you mentioned that you were using the tube stick to record TV shows, I remember that once upon a time there was a problem that the remote scheduling option in Elgato's ITV software caused. That was a similar problem. However, this afternoon, in fact not long ago, I spoke to Equinox's technical support and they assured me that they haven't seen this issue with their software, though there is, I notice, an update for the tube stick software on their website, which leaves the system management controller. Now, that is the computer chip that controls power management in your MacBook Pro. Things like sleeping, waking, the backlight, charging, trackpad control, and so on and so on. So sometimes resetting the system management controller will solve problems like this, and it's definitely worth a try. On the newer MacBook Pros, what you do is the following. Turn off the Mac, so choose shutdown from the Apple menu. Connect the power adapter to a power socket and on the keyboard, and this, I can't stress enough, must happen on the left-hand side of the keyboard, on the built-in keyboard of your MacBook Pro, press Shift, Control, Option, and then the power button. Wait 5 seconds, and then press the power button again, and that will reset the SMC, and see how it goes after that. I suspect that will fix the problem. And remember, hit those keys on the left-hand side of the keyboard, nowhere else. Back to you, Brad.
All right, Trevor, thanks so much. Three great questions, three great answers. We'll see you on our next episode.
I will see you next time. Take care.
You can always send us your questions to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And please tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to Adam Banks, Chris Finn, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Sakalaropoulou. You can always send us your comments and suggestions to macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. Join us for our next edition on Monday, the 7th of September. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.